Hi, this is Favi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are Latinos Who Lunch, the podcast where we talk about important things like
how Tacos El Gordo has the best carne asada fries outside of Tijuana.
Ooh!
Get it!
Hello, hello, hello.
Kisho.
How are you, Babelito?
Expanding my stomach for the feast that is coming.
Oh my gosh, what do you do for that?
I don't eat.
That's the opposite of what you just said.
I don't know.
A man full of contradictions.
That's me.
Yeah, you're supposed to like eat a lot of food before. Haven't you seen Kobayashi's documentary?
No, girl, what is that?
He just eats and eats and
but
eats.
But who's Kobayashi?
Kobayashi was the world champion of the hot dog eating, Nathan's hot dog eating champion.
And he's skinny.
Yes, it's because his stomach is like bigger than normal, and that's why he can do it.
Damn. Yeah. Okay.
So we're gonna go eat some tacos after this to get ready for more tacos.
Yes. Yes. It's a taco weekend.
What's happening today?
Well, today we have a very, 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 very special guest. One of our favorite guests. We have Irene Mata in the house.
Professor Irene Mata. Bow, bow, bow. Hi, Irene.
Hello, you two.
You might remember Irene from our very popular episode, Live at Wellesley College. Yes. And Irene is doing some research here in Las Vegas. Very important research. With us, Latinos Who Lunch, which is so amazing. So thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, of course, Latinos Who Lunch, what have we lunched? Let's talk about it.
Let's talk about yesterday. So, what do you have?
We went to Tacos El Gordo.
Hallelujah.
My.
We need that sponsorship already.
Yeah, you know what, Tacos El Gordo? Throw us some money because all we do is talk about you guys.
Everybody out there, hashtag Tacos El Gordo Latino, LWL Latinos. I mean, hashtag LWL Tacos El Gordo.
You know what? Forget about it. It's cool. Don't worry about it. So, what was your favorite thing?
¿Qué comiste?
Oh my God, the carne asada fries.
Yes.
Those things gave me life.
That's
and probably took a few years off my life, but it was, right. worth it.
Like a couple months.
Yeah.
A couple months. Yeah, okay. It was worth it.
Okay, let's so explain these to the listeners. What are
in detail.
What are carne asada fries?
So these carne asada fries start off with a base of thin cut, nicely crisped fries.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top, you have a bunch of beautifully grilled carne asada that they make on the spot.
Yes.
And then on top of that, they layer like guacamole and onions and cilantro and chile then sour cream. And then you eat it with a fork.
It's so good. And it has to be in a non-recyclable styrofoam box. That's how you know they're authentic.
It's border food. It's what it is.
Totally.
Yes. It's como un burrito de Winnie. It's like the same concept.
It is. Or a bologna taco.
Yes.
Oh, my. Bologna taco?
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
I told you that's my favorite snack.
I know. I know. Mm-mm. I still am shaking my head even though it's your favorite snack.
Whatever. That's how you were with the burritos de Winnie. Y cuando lo probaste, caíste en un abismo de pasión.
Yeah, you're right. We
were driving on our way to Tucson, and I packed some burritos. It was wonderful. So you had the carne asada tacos, and what other tacos? It was just carne asada tacos?
Yeah, it was just carne asada all day long.
That's beautiful. You know, Tacos El Gordo didn't have their carne asada game down. La carne asada sabía rara, but now it's so good. My favorite thing there, it's lengua.
Listen, I want to talk to you about something.
Dime.
I don't know if I have a crush on the Al Pastor guy because he's cute.
Or because Al Pastor is so good.
Because that Al Pastor is so bomb.
I think it's a combination of...
And just seeing him sharpen the knife, ksh, ksh,
ksh, ksh, yeah. Ksh, ksh, ksh,
ksh. And he's so straight, it's really hot. Anytime a woman walks in, he almost cuts his fingers off.
Don't you just want to date a taquero so you can say... Taquero mucho.
Yeah. And imagine His house probably smells like cebolla.
Cebollitas asadas.
Cebollitas asadas.
That should be in a fucking Bath and Body Works.
And now, coming to the stage, cebollitas asadas.
That would be a good track for name. Huh? Okay, we need to stop.
Okay. Anyway, lunch was really good yesterday.
Yeah.
I had un taco. I always have tacos de tripa there because they make them correct where they you know, cut them really small and then they fry them so they're like really crispy. And you know, tripa's vegan and I'm vegan, so it's like
yeah,
it's that's perfect.
The vegetables travel through that.
Yeah. So
that's exactly what.
So that's why it's vegan.
Es como una ensalada.
Sí, exactamente. So, we have Irene here, and of course, we've been mentioning Irene's visit and how we really wanted to get into Coco, the Disney animated feature film, Oscar-winning animated film. What is the,
you I
like,
don't know.
You're like the guy on Police Academy that does sound effects. That's who you're becoming on the podcast.
That's all right. I'll take it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Remember when you... No.
Yes,
okay.
I remember.
But... you know, a lot of Latinx podcasts did a whole episode on Coco and kind of dissecting it, getting into it. But I was like, let's give it some time so we could really think about the movie and talk about the different things that we loved about Coco, because there was a few things, especially that I loved about it. But then also the things that, you know, here at Latinos Who Lunch, we've talked about in the past, like exoticism, appropriation, just things about like cultural identity that are represented in the movie.
And we wanted to talk to you about it because we started this sort of conversation in the last podcast. You talk about myth, the myth of America, and movies. And when you mentioned those details about the Selena movie, I was dying. I'm like, oh my God, if we can do this with Coco or something like that, it will be amazing.
Yeah. Let's dive into that a little bit. Just the Selena comment that Irene made on the podcast, on the live podcast.
Yeah, because you mentioned it was like the myth of America through the dad, not through Selena.
Right.
Yeah.
The film is really much more about the dad's dream of becoming a success than it's about Selena.
Interesting.
And this is a perfect segue because the movie Coco, like the movie Selena is titled Selena, but it's really about Abraham Quintanilla, right? Mm-hmm. The movie Coco is the great grandmother in it, but the movie is not about
her.
It's not about her.
It's about the little boy. ¿Cómo se llama el güey?
Miguel.
Damn, you're good.
I just said that.
Miggy. I call him Miggy. I know him. Yeah, it's about him and his and, you know, it's another boy. It's another movie about a boy and his dog, basically. And, right?
But, yeah, it is.
Let's start with the positives.
Okay, great.
Yeah, let's start in a good note before we go sour. Why do you like this movie?
So I think that one of the things that I appreciated tremendously about Coco is the fact that it represented a family that wasn't dysfunctional in the traditional ways in which it's, you know, Mexican-American, Chicanx families, Latinx families have been represented in popular media.
Historically, right? Yeah.
Like, we have so much terrible representation of mothers, of fathers, and of children, right? And I think that the fact that we have this, like, young, you know, brown, like, visibly racialized brown little boy who's a joy, who feels joy when he experiences music, that's something very different in the ways in which we've seen, especially young masculine boys, mm-hmm. right, represented in popular media.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that. I appreciated the kind of research that actually went into making the film, because I know that there was a lot of research that people performed in trying to capture some of the traditions of Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah, there were a lot of aspects of how to put together the altar that I was like, oh, okay.
And also, I think in context of what Disney has done in the past, right?
Yeah.
I feel it's very similar to Moana in the ways in which it really veers away from the kind of typical Disney canon, right? Where it centers, you know, these princesses, it centers this whiteness. You know, you have films like Pocahontas, which are super, like, problematic.
So fucked up.
Yeah. Or, you know, like, Islamophobic, you know, in Aladdin, right?
Shit, that's true.
Right? So, I mean, it's just...
Damn
the history of Disney with people of color is a very bad and horrible history, right? Like we can trace back, you know, like all of the very negative, like racial stereotypes that Disney has been employing, you know, from its inception of Mickey Mouse the Mouse, right? With its minstrel figures and its minstrel kind of gestures, right? Or like the white gloves, when you think about like the white gloves that Mickey Mouse wears. So it's like the racism has been part of the Disney imaginary from its inception.
Yes.
Right. So Moana, there was kind of a shift, I feel like, with Moana. And I think we kind of talked a little about Moana before. And I feel like Coco is on the same kind of trajectory of that shift. But at the same time that I really appreciate, actually loved watching Coco, I also never forget that it is a cultural production that's produced by this massive like conglomerate that has made its billions, right, by representing a very specific type of childhood, right? A childhood that centers, you know, a white experience. And yes. So then what happens to all the other children? We as children buy into that and we normalize it. So Disney has a history and a legacy, right, of racism. And it has a history of legacy of instilling in children racism and internalized racism, because that's what we see. That's what we grow up believing. Coco offers us a break from that, but it wasn't because Disney's this incredible corporation that all of a sudden developed a racial consciousness.
Like open and shit, yeah.
They want to make money.
Correct.
Right? It's always about making money.
Which they could have figured that out like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, Babelito, what did you like about Coco?
Yes, there's details. For example, when I saw how the altar was created, it's a very specific, it's very Michoacan, it's like a very specific region. I love the role of the cempasúchil, because the cempasúchil has a central role in the celebration, and that's throughout all Mexico. You can be in Puebla, you can be in Acapulco, you can be in Oaxaca, you can be in Michoacán, and cempasúchil is still this flower that's supposed to call the souls into your altar to eat. Because it's very fragrant, because it's very bright. So that was everywhere. And I love that. Those details about Coco, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
But that is it. I hate it. Well, anyway, what about you?
I liked Coco because I just got emotional seeing that first scene with an entire brown family, like, on the screen. Mm-hmm. Like, just seeing that, like, was like... almost shocking to me. And I'm really close with my grandmothers, and I'm lucky enough that I got to meet a couple of my great grandmas. So like everything was very personal, like in that aspect, right? When you saw the way that they rendered the characters, and it just totally reminded me of my abuelita Cheva, my Guatemalan grandma. She was almost like just like that. So that, to see that portrayed in a Disney movie was pretty incredible. In my work and my art, I play a lot with, you know, Mexican symbolism or Latinx symbolism, Latino, Latina, whatever you want to say. And, you know, just seeing the papel picado used, and it wasn't used in a, you can tell it was well researched. It wasn't used in an offensive way. It was used in a very celebratory way.
Yeah, the beginning, and spoiler alerts, we're going to have
it's been like 2 years since the movie came out.
But girl, I'm sure there's somebody there. Somebody there hasn't seen it. Yeah, in the beginning when they develop the pre-story, whatever it's called, through the papel picado, I'm like, oh, shit, that's beautiful. Clever. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really good.
I think, so when I saw Coco, I actually took my class last semester to see Coco, and it was a very emotional viewing. I think most of the students in the class felt very moved by the film, and I think it connects to what you're saying, Fabi, about the impact that seeing parts of ourselves represented on the screen creates, especially because we haven't had that, right? Like we haven't had the privilege, right, of seeing ourselves represented. Right, in a cartoon, in the ways in which we saw in Coco, right? To see the abuela and actually be able to say, that looks like my grandmother.
But see, to me, that's the perfect use of sentimentality. They get you through that, and then you because of that, you forget to be critical, at least most people, because they grab you by the gut with the figure of the abuela, and the
heart.
No, by the gut.
By the gut.
Yes. Because those things supposed to completely, like, get your nerves, right? And, like, really affect you. And then you're like, oh, like, you. So from the opening scenes, you're completely moved in this very sentimental way. And then you just, you feel like it's not fair to be critical to such a sweet thing. But as soon as I see those things, that's my first red flag. I'm like, oh, here we go. And then I just get very pessimistic. But that's my job, so that's okay.
It's your job to be miserable. That's very true.
It is.
And but also, this is the way that I watch a lot of things too. Like when it comes to any cultural institution that I'm part of, or any art show, or anything that I make, I'm always thinking like, if my family was here watching this, my brothers, my abuela, my tías, what would they think about this movie? Right, like.
My family loved it.
Not everybody. Yes, we run in circles with scholars, a lot of academics looking at things really critically, who are just going to the movies to escape and to enjoy something. And I think that's very necessary for mental health. But to see somebody and see a story represented that actually kind of relates to you, I think is really cool and really special.
No, coming from the racist history of this company.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just overall, like, silent film in Mexico started because they wanted to counteract the negative stereotypes that silent film was creating in the United States about Mexicans. Yeah. So from the beginning of cinema, we've been dealing with these problems. Yeah. So for that reason, yes, I appreciate it. It's just that I feel like at this point, we should be way farther than Coco.
Absolutely.
I think that's why I have all my issues, and I'm going to continue to be critical, you know?
I think that for me, when I sat in Coco, and I actually trace it back to when I went to see Book of Life. I don't know if either of you saw Book of Life.
I kind of liked that movie.
I mean, there were a lot of things that I liked about it. Mm-hmm. And then again, I'm also very, very critical about other aspects of that film. But I remember I went with my girlfriend. We went to go see it. And we were probably the only adults in that theater without children, so that was awkward. But the majority of children in that audience were not children of color, because we went to a suburb. We went to a theater in a suburb. They were mostly white kids in that audience. And they were laughing, and they were really into the story. And then when we were leaving, I started crying, not necessarily just because of the storytelling itself, but because what it meant to me to see parts of my culture represented positively in a film, I hadn't realized how hungry I was for it. Even though I'm a scholar and I write about this and I critique film all the time, like I hadn't really understood that hunger that the little girl inside of me felt. So watching all of these young, you know, kids, mostly white kids, enjoying this film that wasn't like a masterpiece, wasn't great storytelling, was very moving for me, not just because of like my own experience as a viewer, but because these children at such a formative age were being exposed to a part of my culture that they had never seen before, that they would never learn in schools, right? That their parents are not going to teach them about. And whether or not, you know, they get it, right, they are still walking away with a much more complex understanding of what it means to be someone of a Mexican ancestry, descent. Right? Yeah. And so I think Coco does the same thing. And Coco on a much wider scale, because Coco was huge, right? Like it.
The Book of Life wasn't.
Book of Life was not huge.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can think about why. But
well, yeah, that's just because of marketing and
the money behind it. And it's not Disney, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's the same thing. It's like you have all of these children who don't have family members who are Mexican, who don't have, you know, friends who are Mexican, who don't grow up in communities with Mexican peoples or peoples of, like, even, you know, not just Mexican, but like Latinx peoples. And their image of Mexicans that, I think about like what we're hearing right now, and we have been hearing for the past 2 years since the election, you know, of 45. Like Mexicans are rapists. Mexicans are drug dealers. This is what children also hear.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's all you hear, right, it's really hard to grow up having a different image, a different vision. And so Coco does do something to make an intervention in that, right? Like it illustrates this family that's not like a violent family. It illustrates a family that's loving, right? Even though the family is making choices for Miguel that we may not agree with as viewers, because we're not supposed to agree with that. Right? There is still something very powerful about giving children a positive image of Mexicans. Now, is it done? Again, is it done because Disney's like trying really hard to be good? Absolutely not.
I don't know. Like I just can't get over the visuals. I can't get over how this ties into a long history of exoticism of Mexico.
Let's get into the exoticism because
years
ago I went to Mexico and I was there during Day of the Dead and I saw what was happening because that 007 movie had come out already where they had the big Dia de los Muertos parade, which really isn't a thing.
It is now.
It is a thing because it happened in a movie, which is super interesting. How pop culture and like this fictional thing has become a real tradition. Shout out to the Bible. So I really want to get into the symbolism, the symbology, is that a word? In the movie?
No,
probably not.
Symbolism. Yeah, sure. Okay,
so of course they tap into many things. The pre-colonial, like pre-Columbian, pre-Spanish, pre-everything. Architecture, like you see pyramids and things in there. You also see, like you mentioned, Babelito, early Mexican cinema, specifically 1940s, 30s architecture. Mm-hmm. A lot of old European influence architecture that's, you know, like the pride and joy of a lot of places, especially in Mexico City. And of course, we have the exotic Frida Kahlo. Frida Kahlo's actually in
the movie. Like that
it's
was
her
world,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just a few things for us to discuss.
And the border.
The thing is that there's a long history of how Europe has imagined the Americas and then how the United States has imagined Mexico. And to me, that's part of that same lineage. And for that, it's hard for me to give it the benefit of the doubt.
Absolutely. But I would argue that that's why it was successful.
Yes, absolutely.
Like they had to do that. Yes. I mean, well, first of all, they didn't have to, but it's like outside of their realm, maybe, right? Like Disney's understanding or imagining of the world, right, is so U.S. centric and so based on these like histories of white supremacy that's the only way that they see people of color. That's the only way they see, you know, countries that are populated by people of color.
That makes me fucking so angry.
And so in order to sell this world, they create this like vision of what Mexico looks like that is not real.
That hasn't progressed since 1940.
It's nostalgic and it's non-threatening.
Correct. That's the thing. It's not threatening to white audiences. It's safe enough. And that's the same Mexico that is portrayed by Frida and Diego. This is the same Mexico that is portrayed by the Vogue of everything Mexico that was also part of like 1930s, 1940s. So it's almost like the United States accepted the visual culture of Mexico once, and it was in the 1930s, and we still can get over it, and we still are going with that.
It's like, we'll allow Mexicans to have a movie, but let's make sure they're dead.
Yes.
They won't get us if they're dead. Like, bitch, you see The Walking Dead?
Oh my god.
Well, let's put in a border then. Stupid. And make it out of flowers.
Oh yeah. So it's pretty.
So we can burn it up at any second.
Yeah, so this colorful vision of Mexico, I'm done. Like, I'm done.
One. Yeah, have you ever been to northern Mexico? There's no color
there. There's no color there. It's a desert.
And I think, you know, there is this, and I think we see it also in Book of Life, right? This idea of, like, if you're not remembered, you go to the realm of the forgotten, right? This notion that, you know, it is our memories that keep our ancestors alive. Right? There's something very powerful about that, never severing our connections to those who came before us. There's something very powerful about that. Mm-hmm. I think that there's also something to be said about how, like, what happens when you do forget? But I don't think that it had to be done the ways in which the film did it. Like, that, I know it was supposed to be funny. I wasn't laughing. It was supposed to be funny when they do the checkpoint where, you know, you have to agree. You have to go when the x-ray machine shows if your picture has been put on the altar. And if it has, then you're allowed to go through. If it hasn't, then you get turned back. I could not believe that they had actually created this scene because of the fights that we have been fighting, the struggles that we've been having around borders, around the control of borders, around the death of all of the migrants that have happened because of the militarization of the border. And to create this children's film that naturalizes fucking borders, like even in life and death, mm-hmm. the naturalization of borders, like for me, that was unconscionable. I understand what they were trying to do to say that you have to be remembered in order to be able to come back and forth. But did you have to do it in such a like problematic and fucked up way?
And that to me is normalizing this culture like to the rest of the world. Like discussions about the border and trauma about the border is just like everyday for Latinos in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew when I was watching the movie, I'm like, they're really championing all these Chicanx chingones from LA that they hired as consultants for the movie. But I bet none of the people they consulted were undocumented.
I have the struggles.
Because if one of those people was documented, they would not have let that happen in the movie. So all you woke, I'm doing this in quotes, people that helped with this movie, like nobody saw that and saw that was going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. Like that was the one thing. Like I even loved the Frida thing. Like Frida in the movie was so funny to me.
How they made fun of her.
They were making fun of her and people that like see Frida as this god when really she's just. Oh, I'm gonna be quiet. So, but that was the one thing when I saw that in the movie, I was like, fuck, I can't completely be like this is the best thing ever because of that scene. That border scene.
I'm stuck with the notion of nostalgia because here nostalgia it's being mixed with authenticity because of the audiences that it's been presented to. I cannot resolve the combination of both of them, even though they always go along with each other. Nostalgia, exoticism, and authenticity are like sisters, are like brothers.
That's close cousins.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you present them together in this overly colorful fantasy. I don't know. I can't get over it.
Talk about some of the things they use to create nostalgia.
Yeah, for example, like the bottom level of the dead, it was composed by pyramids.
Yeah.
But there were Mayan elements, Aztec elements, and Teotihuacan elements when they're like three completely different cultures, right? And then you have this 1920s, 1930s world. Like the train station was composed from the vitrales of the Hotel Mexico, which is like this like turn of the century, like very French period in Mexican architecture. Also, all the steel, it's very French as well. And then you have the trolleys, which is also a reminder of Frida's Mexico City, right? And then you have what Irene was talking about, the absence of technology,
cell phones.
Yes, there were no cell phones in the whole movie. And if you ever been to Mexico, every fucking body has a cell phone. From la señora que te vende los tamales en la esquina to like the richest person. Like everybody has cell phones.
Yeah, when they were having the party at the end of the movie, I was like, where's the cousin with the YouTube playlist in the corner? Like, you know, that's what they use.
Right.
To do their playlists. Yeah.
So like the scene that I like the most is the talent show. Where you had like the goth kid and then you had the banda. I'm like, right. That's Mexico.
That was the only inclusion of modern day that I saw.
The whole movie.
Other than some of the wardrobe choices. So the only person, there's two people in the whole movie that had contemporary or modern clothes on. It was Miguel and one of his uncles had like a soccer jersey on. Like mm-hmm. from the look like it was from like the 90s or something. Everybody else, it could have been out of the 1930s.
It's like those movies by El Indio Fernandez.
Who the fuck wears that in Mexico still?
Nobody.
And
it's
the people
a part of that image of Mexico as pre-modern, right?
Yeah,
it's the idea of the noble savage is what it is.
Yeah,
it's the idea of safe indigenous people that have accepted Christianity, therefore they're on our side. It's an old, old trope. It's just that in film in Mexico, and these are Mexicans doing this, film in Mexico in the 1940s, all indigenous people wear white and con los sombreros. Like the sombreros and the white clothing becomes a symbol of indigeneity. And it becomes homogenized. You see a film by El Indio Fernandez in Pátzcuaro. You see one in the north. You see one in Xochimilco. And they all fucking look the same. That's what I saw in the movie as well.
Yeah. So let's get into some of the icons that we saw in the movie from the past, right? So I mean, I didn't see Juanga there, but maybe they made it. They filmed the movie before.
They show Pedro Infante.
They show Pedro Infante.
Pedro Infante. Cantinflas.
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 Frida. Did they show Diego too? I think they did.
They did show Diego.
Uh-huh. Oh, they did.
I think they did.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
They show.
And what did all those people have in common?
They're all dead. I mean, in real life, too.
Spoiler alert.
But they died a long time ago.
They're part of the 1940s fantasy.
Yeah, right?
The visual culture. Yeah. Pedro Infante was like the James Dean of Mexico. He was like the biggest figure. And so Mexico has two types of films. It has the of the 40s. It's like the classical cinema that was sold around the world and won Cannes prizes and everything. And then you have El Cinema Popular. That's where you have people like Cantinflas. And that's where they were tapping to. They were tapping the aesthetic of one part of the of filmmaking in Mexico of that period. And then using the stars of the other part of Mexican filmmaking. It was really interesting and really clever because they put a lot together. It was like a capirotada. Like every fucking thing that's supposed to be Mexican safe for gringos was all placed in one single place. But, yeah.
Capirotada. That's such a good word. Capirotada.
I was going to use a scholarly term, but I'm like, fuck it. Capirotada is better.
And now, coming to the stage. Capirotada.
Capirotada. Anyway, that's never mind.
I got you. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. Hold on, the Book of Life. Don't they use Tongolele or I think it's Maria Felix with the white hair?
Yeah, they do.
I think it's Tongolele, yeah.
So one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is the use of the spirit animal or the alebrije in the movie. Do you have anything to add about that?
Why do you look at me?
Because I see your face. What do you think about that? What is the history? So for people that don't know, what is an alebrije?
So alebrijes were created in the early 20th century in Oaxaca. And alebrijes are these small figurines made out of copal, because it's a very soft wood that you can carve, and it's hand-painted. This type this type of figurines are like hybrid creatures that have the head of one animal and the tail of another animal. And this like very fantastical world. However, I think they were highly promoted by white tourists traveling to Oaxaca, and that's how it became a thing. People try to say that it was a white guy who created this. I don't take that. I believe that white tourists made alebrijes
popular
how they are, but I don't think they were created by them. I mean, there's a lot of history behind them. They're early 20th century, and now they're everywhere. And what bugs me about this, what bugs me about Coco as well, is how now as bitter brown femmes were talking about in their podcast, every Day of the Dead now there's gonna be references to Coco. And we're going to forget about the intricacies about what Day of the Dead is. Like, we skipped all of that. Oops. We skipped all of that, and we went directly to that comercialización, including alebrijes. Alebrijes now are a Disney product, not a product of 120 years of small communities in Oaxaca making these things. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then the spirit animal, too, like... What is that? Where did that came from? Like, I don't know.
I don't know, but I love Dante.
Yeah.
Because he's so ugly.
And there's a reference to...
Oh, no. He's the dog. The ugly-looking dog.
With a tongue.
You think it was named Dante because it's a reference to the Divine Comedy and like...
Dante's Inferno.
And like, he's the one who's guiding everybody to the underworld. Really?
Well, isn't the name of the horse Dante in the films that he used to watch?
Oh, I don't remember.
Like, what's his name? De la Cruz.
De la Cruz's horse was named Dante. Too.
I think that's why he named.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Se me fue.
Yeah.
I mean, also,
the fact that he didn't have a DVD player in a secret hideout and a VHS player. Like, what year is this? How did that kid find a VCR? Like, you know how hard it is to find a VCR?
Yeah, that's true.
They're more expensive than DVD players.
That's true. That's true. No, but the story was really well written. Like, I was entertained.
Yeah.
Totally.
So I'll give it that.
So let's talk about gender.
Please.
Yes. Let's do it.
So I always, whenever, you know, we watch Disney films, I think gender is really important.
Yes. Right?
Especially the ways in which Disney has constructed femininity and masculinity. Mm-hmm. And even though, like, we have Miguel, who's this really great character, and we also have, what's Miguel's grandfather's real name? The real grandfather? ¿Cómo se llama?
Gael García.
Gael García's
character. Yeah, Gael García. Another... I have so many problems with Coco. I love it, but I also have so many problems with it. So conflicted. I think one of the things that also, like, really bothers me is the role...
Hector.
Thank you.
I got you.
Thank you. Right? How it's the women in the family, right, who are the gatekeepers. They're the ones that are imposing their view on how the family should function. Right? Like, it's not the men. The men just go along with it. Right? It's the women that are stifling the men.
Mm, you're right.
Yeah.
And that's why he runs away. That's why he ends up in...
Por la abuela.
Uh-huh. Right? And that moment where she breaks his guitar is, like, so heartbreaking. Right? But it's not just la abuela. It's, like, the mother's complicit in this because she's also... You know, like, all of them. Right? And then, like, Mama Grande. Was that her name?
Yeah.
The grandmother? Yes. Great-great-grandmother? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, they're all a part of this... You know, this idea of, and it goes back to this stereotype of, you know, women as the keepers of culture, right? As somehow agents of patriarchy to make sure that it continues to function the ways in which we're trained that it should function. Mm-hmm. And so here's this little boy who's trying to grow up and grow out of the kind of confines that he's been placed in. And it's the women that are keeping him. And how different is that from all of the narratives that we get about how women are the ones that are always...
Advancing. You
know, right?
Yeah.
Like women, when you see... Like, think about all the films that we watch, all the shows that we watch, right? Women are always keeping the men back. They're always holding back their community. It's like, fuck you. That's not true.
That's not right? true at all. It's the opposite.
Do we have to continue... Right, to perpetuate this idea that women are not capable of creating change in our own communities. I mean, that's why so many, like, female activists are ignored. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's why so many, you know,
because they're seen as castradoras more than anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to put it lightly.
Castrating bitches.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So even in this little film about this little boy, it's the women that are standing in the way of progress.
Damn. Well, it's nice to see the truth on film, right?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. She's making it almost cut me. No, I'm just playing. Yeah, I didn't even think about that because it's just part of so of every fucking mm-hmm. storyline.
Yeah.
It's always like, oh, the nagging wife.
Ay, va, la que abuela. Tiene razón. La abuela con la chancla. Let's stop the chancla thing, man. Like, let's just stop that.
Oh, my God. Can we get into that?
Yes, please.
Why is it funny for people to hit people with a fucking chancla? That's not funny. That's violence.
It's violence, but it's also part of that narrative. It's like the mom is the one.
Because it's not the grandfathers who are throwing the chanclas, right?
You're right.
It's not the dads throwing the chanclas.
Nobody talks about...
No, porque los papás tiraron un martillazo. Whoops.
Boom. Yeah. No. Because then we would have to talk about alcoholism.
And that's a whole nother Pandora box. That's you don't want to open, girl.
Oh my gosh.
So are these the types of discussions that you have with your students in your classroom?
Yeah.
Like when you go see this. So give us another example of another movie that you guys saw together and then you went to the classroom and then you just got into it.
Well, I think we, because, so the class I'm talking about is the class is specifically on children's media, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're looking at how otherness is represented or constructed in children's media. So we watch a bunch of Disney films, right? And so then we come back and then we talk about them. And students are amazing because, you know, this is the first time I taught it was this fall, but my class was so willing to go there. Like, mm-hmm. they were willing to kind of separate themselves from the nostalgia they feel about a lot of these films, mm-hmm. right? To really critique what's happening in those films. And so we would have these incredible discussions in the class about everything, because so many of them grew up with these films. Mm-hmm. So many of them have watched these films with their families, now watch it with their siblings. And when we started having conversations about, okay, I'm going home this weekend, how can I talk to my brother about Beauty and the Beast?
Damn.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, or how can I, like, talk to my little sister about Aladdin, which she really likes? Right. Or, you know, so all of these conversations were always really amazing. And so we saw Coco together at the theater, mm-hmm. and we also watched Moana together.
Oh, yes.
And both times my students, like, really were able to kind of capture the complexities that they were also feeling as viewers of these films, right? As mm-hmm. consumers, right? Because that's one of the things that we talk a lot about in class, is like how we are consuming, right, the images that Disney has created for us, especially. And so for many of them, even though they appreciated Moana, by the time we got to the end of the class and we actually watched it together, they would be like, okay, these are the great things about it, but
yes.
this is really problematic.
Yes.
Right? And it was the same thing with Coco. When we went to see Coco, I would probably say that 90% of my students cried, because mm-hmm. I saw them and they were all crying ugly. It was amazing. It was beautiful. But the next time we got into class and talked about it,
they digested it.
Yeah.
That's because you trained them well. Because
they're brilliant and they're willing to go there, right? Mm-hmm. If they weren't willing to go there, we wouldn't be able to have those conversations, yeah. because I can only do so much. They're the ones that have to put in the work.
And what do you say when a student may say something like, well, it's just entertainment, like, what's the big deal? Because that's the first thing I got from, because I tried to have a conversation about Coco with my mom and I couldn't do it. He goes, tu sobrino estaba llorando. It's like that sentimentality thing that they were grabbed in the beginning, and I cannot break that esa malla, like that wall.
So I think that from the very beginning of the class, we talk about how representation matters. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Punto. Mm-hmm. It's not up for debate. Representation matters. We have the scholarship that mm-hmm. proves that representation matters. Mm-hmm. Right? And the minute that they start to think that way, if they haven't already, then they start to understand why representation matters. Right? So they, I feel like that in my classes, you know, there are certain things that we can, you know, discuss and debate and question. But at the end of the day, like, you have to, like, you can't go into one of my classes with the idea that, well, you know, it's just a film, because mm-hmm. then you shouldn't be in my class, because that's not how we're reading this text. It's never just a film, right? It's a set of ideologies that has been put together for us yes. to consume.
And they're part of a history, a very complicated history of those ideologies that have been developing and brewing for 500 years.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I'm always more fascinated about, that people sometimes tend to not forget, but not willing to talk about, how what we live in right now, at least in visual culture, it's a product of something very, very complicated that has been brewing for sometimes even thousands of yeah. years. And so when I see these reiterations of some of these ideas, I just roll my eyes. Like, sometimes I don't even want to engage with them, even though that's sort of my job, you know what I mean? That's cool, though. That's cool that I don't get to do that with my students, because we look at very historical works. Mm-hmm. But I'm always trying to make connections with what's happening right now. But yeah I want to teach a class on film just so we can get into it. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's about that time to take a little break.
Already? Damn.
Yeah. I know, this conversation's too good. Should we do another episode?
Not right now, but yes, we should.
Okay.
I gotta go help with La Discada, man.
Oh, okay. We're gonna talk about that when we come back. Okay. We're gonna take a break. Hi, Babalekis.
Que pajon. ¿Cómo estás, Fabi?
Oh my God, I'm so excited about this weekend.
Dude, it's gonna be so much fun. We're part of Los Angeles Latino Film Festival. Did you know that they haven't held this festival for 5 years? So this is a big deal.
And you know what? Selena's dad woke up and was like, we gotta start this. So thank you to... to Edward James Olmos for spearheading the revival of this festival.
Right. I mean, they started this festival in 1997. So this is been part of the community for a long time. And Latinos Who Launch, along with Locatora Radio, were part of the Vida podcast panel, where we get to interview Tania Saracho, who is the creator of Vida. Have you seen that show, girl?
Oh, my God. I binge watched that show in one day. It is so good. Do it now.
Dude, I binge watch. I only stopped to make arroz con fideo and then I came back and finished the whole thing. That's how good it was.
It is so good.
But anyway, don't forget, Los Angeles Latino Film Festival. It's taking place at the Chinese Theater June 21st to June 24th in Los Angeles, Hollywood area. And of course, unfortunately, the podcast panel is sold out, but still participate in the events because there's so much going on.
Again, the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival.
Down.
Hey, Babelito, have you heard of GIFT, the organization?
Yes, but tell me more, girl.
Well, GIFT stands for Grassroots Institute for Fun Raising Training, and they're based in Atlanta, Georgia. And you know what?
What?
We are going to be part of their conference called Money for Our Movements, a social justice fundraising conference this July 27th through the 29th. So excited.
Me too. Like, you know, we always hear about these big events and these organizations in like the big cities, but we forget that there's people fighting for the cause all over the country. And this is a perfect example for the South. So I can't wait to see what everybody's doing and how they're organizing in el sur de los Estados Unidos, tío.
Again, Babelito and I will be at GIFT's 7th Biennial Money for Our Movement Social Justice Fundraising Conference, July 27th through the 29th at Georgia State University in Atlanta, Georgia. So please join us. We're going to be emceeing the entire event. Girl, I am so excited.
La party is real, man.
July 26th, I will be having an artist talk here at Space in beautiful Portland, Maine. So if any of our listeners in the New England area want to come up, July 26th, I'll be doing an artist talk at Space here on Congress Street in the Arts District. Come on down, check it out. Also, June 6th at Space, my show called Pólvora, my installation, is going to open to the public. July 7th, we're doing this really cool screening. It's a screening of a film called Brimstone and Glory about the tradition of fireworks used in Mexico. I'll also be speaking about the film after that. So much is going on. And I will post that on my social media at Favi Fav. So come on down and let's look at some art together.
Tell me those dates again so we can have them right. We can get them right.
Okay, July 26th, I'm doing an artist talk.
Okay.
July 6th, I'm doing, it's the opening of my installation. July 7th, there's going to be a movie screening that I will be at. And that's also my birthday, so if you want to get fucked up after, let's party.
Qué linda está la mañana.
Also, if you're in the New England era and you want to help me make the installation, the more people, the better, okay? So I'll be installing the work June 29th through July 5th. Oof. Okay, that's all.
Exciting.
And we're back. Man, what a fascinating conversation about Disney's feature film, Coco.
It's just so much. Like, this can go on and on and on and on.
But you know what? I forgot to talk. We forgot to talk about it. It's not the first time Disney has made movies about Latin America. One of their first movies, I think it was their fourth big animated feature, was the Three Caballeros. And before that, actually, was this movie called Saludos Amigos.
Saludos Amigos?
Yeah, Goofy was in that one, and Donald Duck. And that was part of,
the Good Neighbor.
Yes, the Good Neighbor Policy. Because...
What's the Good Neighbor Policy?
So the Good Neighbor Policy was... So there was a lot of tension because of World War II. And so to calm everybody down, the United States wanted to create a positive relationship with Latin America so they could see that they were not on the sides of the Nazis. So the government actually paid Disney to go down to Latin America to make feature films about Latin America to, like, to create a bond or a, ¿cómo se dice? A good neighbor policy, right? Just to be like, hey, we're cool, right? Hey, we're cool, right? Yeah.
And part of it was also result of this really violent and racist and horrible stereotypes that Hollywood had been producing about Mexicans, right?
Right.
You know, the Mexican rapist.
El bandido.
Right. And so FDR actually wrote a letter to Hollywood executives saying, you know, please be kinder to the Mexicans.
Yeah.
Because they helped us in World War II.
No, it was before. Because they were afraid.
Right. Yes.
They were really afraid that Mexico would start to aid.
Yeah. They were for sure that South America and Mexico would aid the Nazis.
Yeah.
And plus also the United States have always had corporative interests, especially in South America and Central America.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at the time, Disney actually didn't have a lot of money, so this was a huge help for Walt Disney and the Walt Disney Corporation. And so they sent pretty much most of their animators down to South America and Mexico to make these little short shorts that ended up becoming the Three Caballeros. So if you ever watch the movie The Three Caballeros, it's Donald Duck, who represents like the stupid American, and then it's Jose Carioca, who represents Brazil and South America,
and he's the bird, right?
They're all birds.
Perico.
He's a parrot, yeah. And then there's the rooster who's like, I think his name is like Juan Pistolero or something. I don't know. He's the Mexican. He's like, arriba, arriba. Like, that's, you know, the stereotype of Mexicans with guns shooting them for no reason.
One of the first maps that shows Brazil, and it shows a division between the territories that Portugal gets and that Spain gets, shows Brazil with full of parrots.
Yeah.
So the parrot has always been synonymous with the exotic Brazilians. So when you, anyway, go ahead.
So anyway, when I was at Wellesley, I actually did an installation based on that. And I think I'm going to keep making work about that movie, because that movie is like you said, like you like to watch all those old movies. It's so fucking problematic, but at the same time,
it's so beautiful.
It's really, if you look behind the curtain a little bit, if you just investigate it, like, why are they really doing this? It's super, super interesting. Yeah. And there's this really great, I mean, specifically for my work, there's this really great whole scene in the thing where they explain the piñata and how the piñata is tied to religion and Christmas.
I need to rewatch that.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And it's only like, it's not even an hour long.
It's like 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's not even an hour long. Yeah. Anyway, just wanted to throw that in there about Disney. I'm actually going to go to Disneyland soon to do some research for my next project.
Dude, so I went to Disneyland. I must have been what, like 10, 11 years old. And then I finally went again like 5 years ago. Oh my God. Writing that It's a Small World, it was terrifying. Ugh. It was fucking horrible. Like, why do they still allow kids to ride that thing?
That's my favorite ride.
It's horrible, man. It's like going into an expo of 1905 in France where they put people in cages for you to be entertained by.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. Ugh, it was horrible.
When's the last time? Have you been to Disneyland in California?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I had kids when I was in California. My kids were... I didn't like children. So I never wanted to have birthday parties. So I would bribe my children.
Be like, I'll take you to Disney.
Disneyland, Legoland, Six Flags, so that I don't have to actually host other children.
Yeah. That's a great idea. Hot tip.
I'm not sure my kids think that now, but
my mom didn't let friends come over. That's my mom too.
So wait, before we do recommendations, are there any other films in between that have this significant cultural importance, like Coco and Los Tres Caballeros?
I mean, Princess Elena, right? Isn't she from
Wait, no, isn't she from Spain?
Oh, she's Spanish, right?
Or some
the Emperor
made up country. Oh, the Emperor's New Groove.
Peruvian.
That's a South American representation, Peruvian. And I tried to watch that movie and I couldn't. The movie was
¿Por qué te ríes?
And I love John Goodman. But the movie, the music was awful. It was like done by Sting. Like, what?
Why?
I don't know. See, because
they should have got.
We have come a long way. They should have got Lin-Manuel Miranda. So
he would have been really young. He probably would have been a baby.
He would have been five. He would have still done a better job.
They should have got a little girl that sings like Cerveza, Cerveza. What's her name?
I love her.
Zulka.
That's my recommendation. No. Oh, that's why my cactuses are dying. The cats eat them. Oh, my gosh. Okay, sorry.
Anyway.
Okay, back to the show. All right, so do we have any recommendations today? We're going to let you go first, Pablito.
Okay.
We'll go on.
So because we are pre-recording a lot of these episodes, I am off when it comes to my game of what's coming out and the new releases. So I figure that this time I will recommend a playlist that Spotify put together. I know not everybody has Spotify, but you can also look at this, Google this playlist and get some amazing names of amazing bands. The playlist is called Distrito Indie, and it's about Sonidos Emergentes de México. So it's all about indie musicians from Mexico, from Tijuana to the F. That's why it's called, instead of Distrito Federal, it's Distrito Indie. And there's some amazing, amazing, amazing music in this. And I really thought it was just about indie bands from Mexico City, but I already saw a couple that come from Tijuana. So it really gives you an idea of how exciting the indie scene is, not only in Mexico City, but in different parts of Mexico. Again, the playlist is from Spotify, and it's called Distrito Indie, and the playlist just came out at the end of March. So it's amazing. Go listen to it. That's my recommendation.
Awesome. Irene?
So I'm going to recommend a documentary that is actually screening on PBS.
Ooh.
It just started screening this week. It's the end of March. And that's Peter Bratt's Dolores, right, which follows the life of Dolores Huerta. Yes. So it's directed by Peter Bratt and produced by Carlos Santana. And it's an absolutely just beautiful love letter to who Dolores Huerta is.
That's awesome.
And the fact that so few people know who Dolores Huerta mm-hmm. is and the role that she had in the creation of the UFW, the role that she had in the mobilization and the organizing of the farm workers is such a tragedy. And one of the things that the documentary does so well is that it illustrates the role that gender had
in activism,
in erasing the activism that Dolores has performed for probably the most of her life.
Is that why we have Cesar Chavez boulevards everywhere and not Dolores Huerta?
Yeah, and that's why, you know, when Si Se Puede, everyone thinks it was Cesar Chavez, but it was actually Dolores Huerta who coined that term, right? So many. But the film, not only is it giving viewers a history that most of them will probably not know about, mm-hmm. like it's inserting her into this history that we have of activism. It's inserting women into this history of activism that are mm-hmm. oftentimes ignored. But it's also very much cognizant of how women have to make sacrifices when they want to organize, sacrifices that men are not often asked to make. And so they interview mm-hmm. her children. Fuck. And it is heartbreaking to hear her grown children talk about how they grew up and how, you know, they wouldn't see their mother very much and all of these absences and how much it affected them. But now as adults, how much they love and value everything that she fought so hard for, right? But the sacrifices that as a woman she had to make, and the ways in which, because she was a woman, because she had all these children, because she had, you know, been divorced and she was a single mom, and, you know,
she was vilified.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Like, the men are horrible to her. So I feel like the documentary, not only is it a beautiful kind of representation of this incredible woman's life, but it also makes very clear how important gender is when we think about activism and organizing, and the burden, the extra burden that it continues to place on women.
Yeah, because you were talking also about Buffalo Brown, right? Which is the complete opposite, who gets completely romanticized, even though he was like...
Yeah, Oscar Zeta Acosta.
Yes, like he was quite a character. So it will be interesting to watch both documentaries, both produced by PBS, like next to each other, and just... and see how role is played. I haven't seen them, so I don't know. Yeah.
So it's on PBS now. Both of them, I think, are on PBS
they
now.
They are both. Yeah, because the one on Oscar just came out like last week. Yeah.
So I'm going to recommend a place this time. And it's this little place in Montebello, California called Club Chico. So
yes.
I've actually never recommended a place before, but we recently went to L.A., for SCUM's second year anniversary. And this is going to come out probably a month from when it actually happened. But while I was there, I kept thinking of how important places like Club Chico are.
Yeah.
And a lot of these, you know, because of social media, because of a lot of these dating apps now, I say dating very loosely, and, you know, the culture of having... a bar or a club as a kind of this gay sanctuary, it's disappearing. And there's only a few places left. And so if you're in the LA area, check out Club Chico, clubchico.com. They're club_Chico on Instagram. They're the ones that host SCUM, and they have events every week. It's a small bar, but it's full of life. It's a safe space. And, I've always felt welcome there. Shout out to Alex, who always...
I was about to say shout out to mi padrino, who, like, I met his husband in the SCUM weekend. It was beautiful. You guys are amazing. Every time we're there, you guys make us feel so welcome. And yes, the first time we went to SCUM and we were in that place, we're like, oh, this is how it's supposed to feel. We feel completely at home. Por eso nos pusimos hasta las chanclas.
Bitch, I couldn't believe it. I literally went crazy. Like, you saw me go crazy. Like, it was so amazing.
Because we were so comfortable.
We were so comfortable.
I've never felt so comfortable in a club, in a bar, in my life before I went to Chico's. So shout out to them.
Club Chico.
Club Chico. Dije Chico's?
You always add extra letters.
That's because he's so weird. El internet.
Y'all need to check out the queer scene in San Antonio.
Yeah.
It's because we don't have like brown queer scene here in Vegas.
We need to start it, dude. I'm going to start my own fucking night.
Vámonos.
You know what? I'm going to put this into the universe. SCUM Las Vegas.
Down
at least once. Let's bring it down here.
Oh my god,
I'll find the venue. Rudy,
that will be so
okay
fun.
Club anyway. Chico, check it out. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you so much, Irene. This is amazing. I want to record 20 more episodes before you go, but you need to enjoy your visit. We're about to have some bomb tacos, I promise. And we hope this is the first out of many different visits, because we love to have you here.
Aww, yeah, thank you.
I cannot believe that you're here in my house in the Latinos Who Lunch studios.
I know. Like, I tell everybody that I'm coming to Las Vegas to visit my Las Vegas BFFs.
Oh my god. You know, every time I listen to that episode, I cry. It's like, to me, was an important step for Latinos Who Lunch, not only ideologically but also professionally. And we have you to thank you for that. And again, thank you so much.
We love you, Irene.
So aww. Much.
So thank you so much to Dr. Irene Mata. Google her, locas. And as always, you can find us at latinoswholunch.com. Email us, latinoswholunch@gmail.com. We will read your letter on the air. Ask us a question. Ask us for advice. You can also help Latinos to Lunch by donating on our website. Just click on donate, send us money on Venmo or Cash App at Latinos to Lunch. And also, while you're at it, it really helps if you leave us a review. You can review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast. Leave us 5 stars.
5 stars only.
Because the more reviews we have, the more represented we are. And representation
is important.
Let's try that again. If you have a moment, please leave us a review on iTunes. Because the more reviews we have, the more represented we are. And representation
is essential.
Okay. I'm Fabi Fab.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.